Thanks, Marlene. Over the next 15 minutes, what I hope to do is show you evidence that what Ted, Thea, and Rochelle presented actually does work. I have no financial commitments to disclose, to say first. I'm not going to talk about Ted, Thea, or Rochelle's program because obviously from their presentations you can see that they have and are still making significant contributions to the literature. There are going to be some common threads through to the data that I'm going to present and, about the programs. And those are that they are interested in assessing safety, retaliation risks, individual and family counseling, group support, legal support, life skills training, chemical dependency treatment, mental health treatment, employment training, program evaluation, and others. And I think you've already seen from what Ted, Thea, and Michelle have said that these things are common threads throughout the programs. I called this site Early Pioneers. You can see that the data I'm talking about now from Cotton Crossfire only comes from 2004, because this issue has really only been addressed in perhaps the past 20 or 30 years. I think it was about in the 1970s that Surgeon General Coop then first said this is a public health issue, and I think that is when we really began to try to put public health into this issue. This is data from Marla Becker and Dean Calhoun, who really are pioneers in the field. Ann and Joe here sitting in front are from that program. And what they did was in 2004 is really quite significant. They did a case comparison study. It's a 6-month post-injury period. And what they found was that the interviews they looked at were 70% less likely to be arrested, 60% less likely to have any criminal involvement. It was a short period of time. They didn't talk about, there was no difference in re-injury rates or death, but again, their recidivism rate to the hospital was less. And that was significant data. It was one of the first times that, again, that people began to publish data that says that perhaps hospital-based violence programs can make a difference. This is again another important study. This is from our moderator, Marlene Melsa Langer, who's at Project Dream in Milwaukee, and she did again a very important study. They looked at 200 patients aged 10 to 18, and again they addressed the issues that I showed you in the first slide. And what they again found was there's only a 3% return rate post the first year. Now there was no control group in this group. They were done different time periods, but again, a 3% return post year was encouraging data. This is from Leslie Zhu, who's one of our participants in our program. Again, this is one of the first groups that did try to do a somewhat randomized study. This is a 12-month evaluation of folks who were seen again in their ED, and what they found was that for the treatment group there was an 8.1% return rate to the ED, but for the control group, are the group that did not get treatment, a 20.3% return rate. Again, showing that if you can address some of the issues while the patients are in the hospital, that you can then have an impact on the recidivism. I want to briefly mention another program in Chicago called CSFAR. They are part of you perhaps know them from a recently released movie called The Interrupters. And what they have in the community is violence interrupters who try to go out in the community after an event and try to address the issues with the folks in the community about what has occurred and try to prevent things like retaliation. Again, their data they published in 2006 and 8 also showed that in comparison to communities without these violence rates, there was a decrease in the violence rate. And more recently, this is data from the Indianapolis. This is the Wishart Hospital, and they have only been in existence now for about three years. This is their first year data here, looking at the folks enrolled, most important, looking down here at the recidivism rate, that only 1.3% of the folks have recidivism after, again, 2 years of data. Again, addressing only the issues that put them in recidivism. It's not a randomized study, but it's comparing the groups. Compare the groups as they compared to what they had before. This is a significant decrease in recidivism rate. And timing is important. And what you've heard Ted, Thea, and Rochelle talk about is seeing these patients at the bedside at the time of the interventions. This is data from Tina Chang, who's in Baltimore, and she was looking at patients seen in the ED. It's a randomized control trial, and what they found that there was no difference in the rate of reentry, and there's no difference in community service utilization. If you look closer at her study, however, the intervention often started weeks after the injury, and there was a large number of folks lost to follow up. So again, it emphasizes the model that we have in our national network, again, seeing the patient at the time of the injury and using this as a teachable moment. And finally, this is data from Johns Hopkins as well. And this is data from a guy named Eddie Quinwell, who's currently chairman of surgery at Howard University. And this data was done when he was director of trauma at Johns Hopkins. When he first went to Hopkins, there was not an organized trauma service. There were folks who would take trauma call and then go home. There wasn't a service which patients were admitted to on a regular basis. So when he went there in 2000, he said that we're going to have a group of surgeons who are committed to being on the trauma service. They will take call and we will set up protocols for how we're going to do business. And what we're going to do is we're going to measure what happened when we organized the trauma service and what happened after it. So in 2008, when he got there, was the time of the beginning of the data. And 2005 was, again, obviously 5 years later. And let's look at we're looking just at mortality. Now, when he looked at blunt trauma, car crashes, falls, hit by football player, the mortality rate was significantly improved in all those categories in blunt trauma. However, when he looked at folks admitted to the ED of a violent injury, the data wasn't nearly as good. The mortality early, when it was 2000, was 3%. Mortality late, 4.3%. So no significant improvement in those folks who were admitted because of a violent injury, again, compared to those who were admitted because of nonviolent injuries. If you look at the DOA and non-survivors discharge, again, 1.7% early, 3.1% late. At the best, no significant difference, and perhaps a little bit worse. And if you look at ER mortality and gunshot wounds to the head, it accounted for 82% of the deaths. What it's saying is that our ability to take care of our patients who admit violent injuries is much less than those folks who admit with blunt injuries. And if we think about it, if we look at the data for folks admitted to our hospital for deaths in perinatal violent injuries versus blunt injuries, you are much more likely to die at most of our trauma centers if you're admitted for violent injury versus a injury from an MVC or fall. So within the last few minutes here, I'm going to just look at some of the data, some of the ways in which we took our data and tried to build on evidence so that you could use it to make Thea's point to our constituents. And so when we got involved, this was about 2000, and it was clear that patients who we all had clear thoughts on what the risk factor for being a victim of violence, but no one had actually looked at it in a case-controlled fashion. So we essentially compared patients admitted to our hospital because of a blunt injury, car crash, fall, etc., versus patients made up by a hospital cause of violent injury. And we asked the question, what are the risk factors for being a victim of violent injuries? And it was, the data is not surprising. This was 200 cases, 224 open calls, majority of African Americans. Again, the distribution were gunshot wounds, beatings, and stab wounds. And you can see here that, briefly looking at the data, that they were primarily, again, this is the cases are in blue, the controls are in white, and you said the majority were African American, the majority had less than high school education, the majority had spent time in jail, the majority were raised by parents. Significant differences, again, in those folks that made it to our hospital for a car crash fall versus a violent injury. They were more likely to be unemployed, more likely to be uninsured, more likely to have an income less than $30,000. Emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, history of alcohol abuse, drug use, admitted for psychiatric care, family members in prison. Again, this is the sort of the daunting task that you're up against when you decide that you want to build a program. But again, they are our patients. They were observed. They observed family violence. Family involved in violence activity, they observed friends involved in violence activity, immediate family members' murders, all significantly increased in our cases versus those folks admitted to your hospital because of a car crash. And 86% of them felt that the suspect was an element in them getting injured, i.e. an inability to resolve a conflict. This was the summarization of the data. Here are the risk factors. That's the high school education, unemployed, income less than $10,000 per year, African American male, from dysfunctional families, complex estrous behavior, violent neighborhoods, uninsured, shift substance abuse, history of incarcerations. Not exactly the folks in whom you can say that choir boys, for lack of a better term, but these are our patients. And so the question is then how can you build a program that is going to affect, going to impact them? So we then took that data and said here's what, and built our program. This was our eligibility criteria that we used. We especially looked at, again, patients admitted to hospitals of violent injury. Previously, we were there who were currently on probation, and we did basic academic questionnaire and randomly assigned them to an intervention group versus a non-intervention group. And I'm going to again briefly do the data. This is the intervention group here. They were assigned a social worker and caseworker, probation officer. A service plan was devised. Individual family meetings, home visits, group meeting visits. Visits to the jail versus, again, the non-intervention group, which are standard post-op care and follow-up. All acute injuries were treated by the same groups, and there was a 3-year follow-up. This is basic demographics showing that our randomization was appropriate in terms of sex, race, age, marital status, etc., as well as education, medical, insurance, and disabled. So, again, randomization worked. There are 56 patients in the intervention group and 44 in a non-intervention group. And our data, you can see here, the non-intervention group is here, intervention group is here, and you can see there wasn't really a significant difference between ever arrested. Again, saying that our patients live in an inner city, they do things like loiter, or get picked up for marijuana, etc. So they do get rearrested, and I think that's just a fair assessment of what it's like to be a part of the inner city. If you look at every risk of a violent crime, however, you can see that the patients who were part of the intervention group were 3.2 times less likely to be arrested for a violent crime. They were 2.3 times less likely to be convicted of a violent crime, times less likely to be convicted for a violent crime. If you look at jail time, if you look before the program at the two groups, there's really no significant difference. You could argue that the group who got the intervention was actually a little more difficult than the non-intervention group. But look, after the program, again, significantly less money spent on the folks in the imaging group, and of course they simply less time in jail as well. And if you look at what the folks that Dia talked about want to know about, they want to know whether they, whether the folks are being readmitted to a hospital because of a violent injury. And you can see here after the program, there were only three folks readmitted to the hospital because of an injury versus the non-injury group, 16 folks were readmitted. It's important to say, note that of the folks who were readmitted, two of them died and from violent injuries, and both of those patients were in the non-intervention group. So I think it's fair to say that from this, and then if you look at things like employment, and we look at the various employment, reacquaintance with their family, substance abuse, etc., and you can see that, again, after the program, the injury group was much more likely to be employed. So I think in conclusion that, again, the hospital-based volunteer program is an effective means of reducing violent recidivism. I think it's important, and one of the things you've heard throughout this discussion is that we have to get more of this data. If we're going to make the argument that hospital-based violence intervention programs should be in every ED and every trauma center around the country, this is the kind of data that we have to continue to produce. And I think from what you've seen with Ted and Michelle and Thea today, their programs are very much on the road to doing that. Thank you for your time.
We have some time for questions. Yes?
For the data part, you talked about how you got the trauma registry to automatically download data into the database you created. Was that a difficult integration process, or
apparently it's getting more complicated right now because we're switching systems. The trauma registry group is switching systems, and the software company's having a little bit harder time with the new system, but it's taking some time, and we pay a monthly maintenance fee. So we're really that money is going to good use right now because they're struggling with it. So apparently, the old system that a lot of hospitals use was fairly simple for them, but the new one is a little bit trickier.
Yes.
A question about funding. So two things that came to mind to me were, one was the requirement for nonprofit hospitals to now conduct a community needs assessment, and whether that could perhaps leverage the hospital to invest in violence prevention interventions. The other one being the expansion of Medicaid to individuals without dependents and kind of getting reimbursed for your services through Medicaid. Is NNACIP thinking about these sort of things?
Absolutely. I think that we are, it's important. We've been trying to look at these things and see how we can take advantage of them. One of the important things we have to do is buy-in from the national organizations that all of us are a part of. The American Emergency Medicine Association, American Association of Surgery, Trauma, American College of Surgeons, and we are all making inquiries and trying to buy in from them. But one of the things that's important from their perspective is data. They are they don't buy the touchy-feely at all. They say, show me data that says that it's effective, and then we can make a change in how we practice, because it's going to be, it affects how they do things. It affects a little bit of their budget as well. So we have to make the argument in a manner that shows that they don't care what all these other folks are doing over there. It says, show me the data, and then we will go to bat for you. So that's what we're trying, and that's why some of the stuff that I showed you is so important. But yes, we have made inquiries to our leadership, and it's to our leadership that we can then get that conversation with the folks who are at the table for those discussions.
To address the second part of your question also, I think one of the things that's going to have to happen, particularly in Massachusetts, where this sort of Romney Care thing, evolved, back in prior to the new healthcare system there, our hospital used to, 70% of our patient population is government insured. And before this renovation sort of thing of this new healthcare thing, our hospital used to receive $220 million to care for, to give free care to people who were uninsured. And when the insurance thing was redone, they took that $20 million from us and used it to provide health insurance to that uninsured population. And initially we were concerned that those patients wouldn't come to us anymore because now they could go anywhere. Well, we still receive those patients and more, and the majority of this population we're discussing is uninsured, victims of violent injury who are youths. But they're still coming to us, but at 60 cents on the dollar. And so as opposed to other hospitals in our city who are also level one trauma centers who are getting like $1.05 or whatever on the dollar. So, they're going to have to like even that playing field, just to address the second part of your question.
Yeah, I think the other thing about it is the pitch you can make to, I'm in a children's hospital where 62% of our patients across the board in the ED are under government insurance, and many of the violently injured have no insurance because they're 17, 18 in that age group. One of the pitches you can make is that if you can prevent the repeat injuries, there is definitely health savings, and that's been my tact in my hospital. In Wisconsin, we have the Wisconsin hospital tax, which shifts money from hospitals who are making the $1.05 on their billing over to hospitals such as ours who are more government funded. However, in the next couple years, it's likely that hospital tax, at least in Wisconsin, is going to go away and we will have more struggles. Yes, sir.
It's a part of the process, but it's specific to it includes the child death review as well.
Okay.
But that's a part of it just in Philadelphia.
Okay. And then the second question, I guess, which is an open question, I was wondering if you could speak to the role that community partnerships play in facilitating the success that we've seen in terms of reducing the rate of brain injury.
It's hugely important. I often, when I talk about the program, I also say that we're just one small piece of the whole pie, and that we're identifying them and starting the ball rolling. But it's really through making the connections and building the partnerships with other organizations within the community, preferably that have an understanding of how community violence impacts families and children, preferably. But that's difficult to find. But we do, in fact, have other partnerships. To name one specifically, we work with Townwatch Integrated Services. There's another organization, Every Murder is Real. And we're also developing other partnerships that are hardcore grassroots organizations that know the community, know the lay of the land, know when things are happening, and work with them so that we can make sure the kids don't cycle back in.
It'll be important to go out and vet those programs. Before we began our program, we spent a lot of time just going out and talking to programs, seeing what they're all about. Is that substance program that we want to refer them to, is that going to be the right one? Some of them are religious-based, some of them are more based on other things, so it's important to have a conversation so it's clear that your patients, you know what you're sending them out into. Because if you send them out to something where they're unhappy, they don't meet the right match, then it winds up being a difficult situation. So vetting them and spending time in that process is important.
I want to just second that by giving an example that we have two tattoo removal services and community-based organizations we work with which we work in the Mission District because some of our clients can't go to one of them and the others can't go to the other one. So we have to do what's appropriate and be savvy about that, and that's all because our case managers get it. They understand those things.
I agree with everyone else. I'm sorry.
I think the other thing is if you have community-based organizations where you want feedback, such as in Milwaukee, we work a lot with the Milwaukee Public Schools on getting kids back into school, but we would like to know what happens, you know. And so we've worked pretty hard on developing a consent form that parents can sign so that we can exchange information between the community-based organization and with the hospital. And now that's a little tricky. It took us a little bit to get there, but it's really important to be able to get the feedback of did those services work. And you can't, there's some of the services aren't going to be the right match. Most of the time, especially mental health services, there are a lot of different places that people feel comfortable, but mental health services really have to be individualized. And if you know someone can't speak English, you're going to have to find mental health services that are going to be able to speak Spanish or Hmong, at least in my community. So you have to kind of make sure it fits. Yes.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your talk. Many of you talked about how violence not only impacts the injured person, but also their networks as well. And so I'm wondering if you can talk specifically about how your programs are working to facilitate healing in those networks, whether you're providing direct services or connecting them with community partners that might be able to provide services in that regard.
In our program, we have, we have some people who are on our staff who actually do that intervention with families and children, parents and children. But we also have some connections with the larger community-based type interventions. For example, the Boston Public Health Commission has an entire section on trauma and violence, and they have what's called a community response team, and there's a person who actually is sort of deployed to the area where this event happens. And they meet with the youth in the community and sort of facilitate the various types of needs that they will have. And they are connected with us, so we have, you know, communication back and forth around that, you know, as an example. I mean, they have a lot of networking throughout the city for this type of thing. And Dr. Rich was the medical director for the Boston Public Health Commission, and you probably could speak more to it as well, John, perhaps.
It's actually imperative that you assume that you're going to have to, that you're going to treat the family support people, because if you don't, they will show up. When we first began our program, you know, we sent our clients home, and then they'd come back and they'd bring mom, dad, baby's mama, sister, etc. And we were a little bit surprised by that. And I thought, well, geez, how are we going to be able to support all these people? And they are their support network. If you're going to have success with that client, then you have to include that network of folks that are part of it. And so it's just that. And so it's absolutely key that you are ready to include all of their extended family.
You know what? A lot of them come to the ED at the beginning, so you get to meet them. In Milwaukee, we also have a boys and girls group, but we also have a family support group, and we do celebrations around the holidays, around Thanksgiving, and we just celebrate and give people a social network of people who have experienced the same thing and can talk with each other. And it's very powerful how much parents are able to support each other through their child's victimization. It's really important.
I just want to make one little springboard off of that, that we also support each other in what we do. And if you have a program or you want to have a program, come on into our network, because it's just been, we've improved, I know, leaps and bounds in San Francisco because of this incredible network, not just with us, but our case managers, our research assistants, social workers. So it's a huge benefit to have a group, and it's really been helpful. So we welcome you.
Can I follow up on your pitch, Michelle, just to say, if you go to nhvip.org, you can sign up to be on the, you know, get our email, get the information. I brought with me in my hand a book that basically is the combined wisdom of these folks plus some other partners in Philadelphia and Chicago, that basically all the sort of things that we've learned so far about how to set up these programs. And we're going to make that available. We're going to publish it online this coming month. So, you know, if you go to that website and sign up, you can
say again.
Yeah. nhvip.org. There's a flyer in the back.
sign-in sheet, too, if you're interested, and we can email it to you as well. So we'll put that in the back.
And we have a handout on the APHA site, too, so that you can click on it. That's part of Thea's presentation. Snuck it in there. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm
with
the
science
side.
Oh, sure.
That whole system I'm part of, there's a response team for partner model screening, so not necessarily people that are injured or come in because of trauma, but there's a positive screen by physicians, we have case managers, social workers, who we can get into the ED or wherever the patient is. What do you think are lessons learned from the youth violence programs for how partner violence programs could work better or in that work or other end of lessons?
Sometimes there's partner violence in the cases that we see as well. And I would imagine that the same services that we use to support victims of the violence that we're talking about here would also serve you up. So that type of person, because I'm sure, for example, that not only those people are victimized, but people in proximity to them are victimized as well. And what sort of situations were risk factors for that, and what you can do to intervene to, support them in that way, what type of services you could do to help them in that way.
Yeah, I'll echo that too, and I would say, interestingly, by default at our institution, we are the partner violence people that are called when someone comes in. But it's, again, establishing a network and recognizing who the partners in the community are that work well with that particular issue. So again, it's identifying some of the community partners that work specifically with that particular issue.
And I think also staff support, because those folks that are coming in, they need a lot of support as well. The people who are, the helpers, the interventionalists, they need a network to be a part of, to compare notes of, which community agency is going to help out. And they just need emotional support, too.
And if I can go back to just one of the questions he asked about getting hospital buy-in. And one of the things that we've experienced, this is an unusual pothole is out there, but occasionally their hospitals don't want to decrease their private recidivism because it is money coming in. And so, I mean, from a ethical, moral point of view, it would seem, obviously a little bizarre, but so it's important that you make the moral ethical argument as well. And it's important that you have an understanding of your institution and what is going to make them interested in doing it. And that involves spending a lot of time with the folks who wear the suits and talking to them. And it will become obvious, because they'll tell you in the sidebar what the conversations are, what their interest is, and what will make them, which they won't say in a public venue. But it's important to have to clearly have an understanding of what their interest is.
Super. Well, I'd like to thank our presenters today. And if any of you have questions or you'd like to come up and yak with us, come on up.